I thought we'd look at, briefly, look at philosophy today, really, and next week end up with Hinduism and modernity. So, Kerala, we'll have to wait.
Oh,
there's an extra one, is there?
Yeah.
Has everybody got a handout? Yeah. Mark, have you got one?
Yes.
Yeah.
Okay.
Okay, thanks. So, I apologise for the odd type of script on some of this, but I don't know why it happened. Now, the term philosophy has often been used to describe systems of ritual, systems of thinking that arose alongside ritual traditions in India. Although what counts as Hindu philosophy would only partly be recognised in departments of philosophy in Western universities. And in some ways the term theology is more important, is more appropriate perhaps, although some schools are atheistic and are not concerned with a theos at all. And you could include Advaita Vedanta, arguably, in that, not being concerned with a theos. Or Pratyabhijna as well. Now, so when we examine Indian philosophy, in many ways we're venturing into a new kind of territory, quite distinct from the development of Western philosophy, and yet there are overlapping concerns with the nature of existence, with language, with logic, and with the methods of knowing. How do we know anything? So what we are doing when we, and by we I mean those within the Western Academy, approach Indian philosophy, interesting questions arise as to why we should do this and what is to be gained by it. Is it purely an exercise in the history of ideas? Or does Indian philosophy have anything to say to contemporary Western philosophical concerns? Wilhelm Halbfass has written an interesting list of questions, which include, which I've given you on that handout there, can we expect genuine discoveries and clarifications from Indian texts? Should we expect nothing more than exotic cases of conceptual and grammatical confusion and exemplifications of linguistic and cultural relativity? Do these texts deal with questions that are still significant for us? Can they teach us about different questions and about different types of significance? Have we gone beyond the Indian questions and answers, or may we hope to rediscover dimensions of the problem of being that have been neglected, obscured, or buried by the development and ostensible progress of Western philosophy and science? Can we expect to clarify our own tradition of ontological thought, its meaning and limits, by comparing and contrasting it with the Indian tradition? So he raises these interesting questions, but he doesn't go on to answer them. He then says that we can't answer these questions because we have to know what the Indian traditions are first. And that task of knowing what they are, that task of description, is not completed, as it were. So that's his argument. But I think, nevertheless, as some people do, you can argue that Indian philosophy is relevant to Western concerns, and you get philosophers like Guennari at Liverpool who develop Indian philosophy in the context of Western thinking, and indeed Matilal here did before, or tried to. So it's an interesting question then, is there ground for comparison? And one suggestion is that such ground is provided by logical and linguistic analysis. So there's, Matilal was keen on this, so that there are strong areas of overlap, particularly in terms of logic and the analysis of language. We'll be focusing today on some of those aspects on logic and language later on. Okay, so there's a problem with the category philosophy and its application outside of a Western context. What are the Sanskrit or Indian analogues to the term philosophy, or indeed theology? And there are two terms particularly that are given rise to within the tradition. Darshana, from the verb drish, to see, so you could translate that as perhaps critical worldview, something like that. and Anvikshiki, which is the analysis or investigative science, particularly logic or nyaya. So the term darshana refers to orthodox systems of thinking, not only to those, but also to any worldview, critical worldview, really. So the Buddhists, Jains, materialist philosophies are all considered to be darshanas. And the Hindu darshanas arguably contain the following features. They assume the Veda as revelation, and that's what distinguishes them from other kinds of philosophy, like the Buddhists or the Jains. They claim to have liberation as their purpose. That's a trope or a theme within these. They all say the first few verses, our liberation is our purpose, but then they go on to say nothing else about it, really, and talk about logic or epistemology or whatever their concern is. They're exegetical in nature, as was theology in the West, expressed in commentaries and sub-commentaries on revelation, and on primary texts called sutras. If you remember, there's a primary revelation, then you get the smriti text, sutra, particularly sutra material, and philosophy tends to be commentarial on these texts. And particularly a text called the Vedanta Sutras. And indeed, to establish a school of thought, you were traditionally supposed to write a commentary on this foundational text. Now, there are arguably two issues in Indian philosophy that they're all concerned about, which is indeed what much philosophy in the West is concerned about, is what is there, what exists, i.e. ontology, and how can we know anything, i.e. epistemology. So those are two primary issues in Indian philosophy. What is there, ontology, and how can we know anything? And I'll be returning to those two presently. And a brief chronology of all this, you've got various periods of Indian thinking. This is Halbwass's division. There's pre-systematic speculation in the Vedas and Upanishads from 1200 to about 400 BC. So the Upanishads contain speculation about the nature of the universe and so on, but it's not really philosophy in the sense of developing arguments. And then you get the classical systems that develop philosophy, i.e. Buddhism, Jainism, and the various traditions subsumed under the category Hindu, although the word Hinduism was not in use at this time. I don't think it was even coined until much, much later. So, and then you've got the Shaiva and Vaishnava systems, and to some extent the Shakya systems from the 8th to about the 18th century, in which you have theological arguments which draw on the classical systems very significantly. And in those, you get really reiteration of moves that have already been made in the classical system. So you don't get much innovation or new kinds of thinking emerging, although you do get a kind of symbolic logic with Gangesha about the 14th century, I think. And then you get, from the 19th century onwards, you get modern Indian philosophy, which largely responds to Western philosophy in the 19th and 20th centuries. So you go to contemporary philosophy departments in India, and they're much like American or British ones. They're concerned with analytical philosophy, concerned with nature of language and neurology and these kinds of computer modelling and those kinds of things. So they're just like modern West European departments of philosophy, although they might have a course on the history of Indian philosophy. Now, traditionally, philosophy in India was divided into six schools, and these six schools were called orthodox or astika. The asti is it is, i.e. there is a revelation of the Vedas. So they accept the revelation of the Vedas, the astikas. And they were opposed to the nastikas, those who did not accept the revelation of the Vedas, the atheistic Buddhists and Jains and so on. The Jainas and the Baudas. So these six systems, this is a rather artificial systematization, which excludes some major developments within Indian thinking, particularly Shaivism. So the Pratyabhijna is completely excluded from this system, as is Shaiva Siddhanta. I can't remember the date of when it first occurs, but it is a later systematization. Try to make sense of the tradition, which excludes much else. But there's a very important book written in the about 1340 by Madhava, called the Compendium of All Philosophies, the Sarvadarshana Sangraha, which is lists 16 philosophical schools and doesn't mention the six systems at all. Now, of these 16 darshanas, these 16 philosophical schools, it includes the Buddhists and the Jains and different Shaiva groups, such as the Pashupatas and Pratyabhijna, particularly the Pratyabhijna. And it's a history of philosophy. Well, it's not a history, but it's a description of philosophical positions within the Indian framework. So it's a really very useful and very interesting text, in which he tries to outline, it's a kind of phenomenology. It outlines the arguments of the philosophers without making particular judgments about them. So I'd encourage you to, if you're interested in Indian philosophy, to have a look at that text. There's a translation by Cowell, but there may be a more recent translation of it.
Is there one word that equates to philosophy, roughly?
Darshana, possibly.
Right.
Yeah. Critical worldview, darshana. In the West you've got philosophy and theology are distinguished, and historically that's been the case, but in India you've got darshana, which includes some theology, as it were, so the Shaiva traditions could be theological in some sense. But it also, the term darshana also includes atheistic philosophies, and you could argue that Pratyabhijna or Advaita Vedanta are atheistic in the sense that they're not concerned with the theos, but they're not materialistic in the sense of another tradition called the Lokayata. So it's I think the rough semantic equivalent will be darshana. Oh, now you've got these six systems. They're often paired together: Samkhya Yoga, Mimamsa Vedanta, and Nyaya Vaisheshika. They go together, really. The earliest speculation seems to be what's called Samkhya. Samkhya means enumeration, and there's an Indian mathematical journal called Samkhya today, which deals with Indian mathematics. So it really means enumeration, and it's about the enumeration of the categories of existence. So it overlaps with science to a large extent in this early period. And you've got Samkhya dimensions in the Upanishads, some elements of Samkhya in the Upanishads. And it's a dualistic system. It says what you have to enumerate, what you have to distinguish are the categories that comprise the universe. So it's an attempt to describe what constitutes the universe. And two things particularly are important: that there's a dualism between the self and the world, between the Purusha and Prakriti. And Prakriti itself is made up of further divisions called tattvas, or categories or realities. So it's dualistic. There are two real things in the universe, self and matter. And the self is eternally distinct from matter. And the goal of life is to realize the self's non-entanglement with matter or nature. So the self realizes, becomes isolated in liberation. So kaivalya is isolation, which the self is separate from, realizes its distinction from the universe. And this self is not the subject of first person predicate. So when I go to have a drink of water, or I go shopping, that I is not the true self, the subject of first person predicates. The true self is beyond that, is deeper than that, because that I is part of matter, part of Prakriti. So the goal of life is to separate yourself from that. So it's an atheistic philosophy. There's no theos, but it regards... well, it doesn't talk about the Veda very much, but it technically regards the Veda as revelation. But it's concerned with separating yourself from the world. And this is the metaphysical backdrop behind yoga. So yoga, particularly the classical yoga of Patanjali, assumes the Samkhya metaphysical system. Although his text was, I mean, the Vyasa just means sort of editor or something. But there was a commentary on the Yoga Sutras attributed to this character Vyasa, who seems to have written so much. But and that assumes a Samkhya metaphysics. There are also commentaries on the text by Shankara, who tries to reclaim the text for a Advaita metaphysics, for a monistic metaphysics. So those two, Samkhya particularly is very important in that it pervades all the later systems. They all assume the Samkhya categories but reinterpret them. And it's particularly important in the tantric traditions, where the tattvas get added to with another 11. So Samkhya Yoga, I mean, they're technically called systems of philosophy, but the texts are exegetical, and they're Samkhya commentaries on the Samkhya Sutras. But it's less argumentative, it's less systematic argument than is developed later on in sort of Nyaya or Vaisheshika. Another pair, Mimamsa and Vedanta. These are particularly important. We'll look at Mimamsa, the two Mimamsas in a second, in more detail, which is exegesis of the Vedas. And the other one is the Vedanta, or the later Mimamsa, the Uttara Mimamsa. And that Vedanta has probably, due to Vivekananda, has come into the West and is probably the most... the most popular kind of Hinduism, the kind of Hinduism, the form by which Hinduism has been known in the West has been Vedanta and various forms, which is the tradition of the Upanishads. The Upanishads are Vedanta in one sense, because they're the end of the Veda, and this is a school of philosophy that develops out of that. Anyway, I'll be talking about those two in a minute. There's Nyaya and Vaisheshika. Nyaya is logic, school of logic, from the Nyaya Sutras in the first century. And the Vaisheshikas were a school of atomism, as a realist school, which were originally atheistic but did introduce a theos later on, as did the Nyaya. And these were... the Vaisheshika thought that there were... the universe is composed of these minute particles, these atoms or anus, and again, a bit like the Samkhya, the object of philosophy or darshana is the understanding of the padarthas, of the categories that comprise existence. So it's an ontology, really. So it's a mapping of what exists in the universe, and it reduces these components to three basic atoms, which interact with each other. So let's have a look. Now, you should add to that the Pratyabhijna, the recognition school of Shaivism, and the Shaiva Siddhanta, the dualistic school of Shaivism. But they're not incorporated into the six systems, but nevertheless extremely important. So let's look at the two Mimamsas. Let's look at this pair of Mimamsa Vedanta. Now, the two Mimamsas, there were two schools of... these two schools are called the Purva Mimamsa and the Uttara Mimamsa, or Vedanta. And the former stresses action. Let's just call Mimamsa for now. The former stresses action. And the latter, Vedanta, stresses contemplation or meditation. And both are based on a discussion of Vedic scriptures. But both come to very different philosophical conclusions about those texts. So the Mimamsa is the critical inquiry into Vedic texts and a philosophy which attempts to give a consistent view of the world backed up by arguments. So it's philosophy in a way that Western philosophy would understand it. And it claims that its arguments and its view of the world is in accordance with reality. It's tattvata, it's things as they are, in accordance with reality. And the key text is Jaimini's Mimamsa Sutras, which is about 400 BC, commented on by Shabara, who's about 400 AD. And these are further explained by two thinkers who created two subdivisions of the school, Kumarila and Prabhakara, in the early 8th century. Now, there are differences between those two schools, but the key ideas in the Mimamsa texts are that activity is the most important fact about the universe. The universe is characterized by activity, by action, and is the controller of the universe. Action is the controller of the universe, or the force, or the power which makes the universe turn round, as it were. And the Vedas, then, are about activity and enjoying a life of action. They say you must act in the world. That's their function. Now, the Veda for the... Dharma then. Okay, what activity then is key? Activity is the heart of the universe. Dharma is action enjoined by the Veda. The Veda tells you that you should act. And there are two kinds of action, according to the Mimamsa, because those such as prayers, social duties, which must be done, which bring no particular reward, and those which have a purpose, such as happiness in the next world or riches in this world. So they're divided in action. What is action? Actions are of two kinds. Action is for its own sake, or action is for the sake of something else. There are some kinds of action for its own sake, such as Vedic ritual, and there are other actions for the sake of something else, like ploughing a field to grow crops, or selling something to gain wealth. So prayers, social duties, they're action for its own sake, and you only do them because you don't look for a reward as a result of doing them. You should do them for their own sake, because the Veda tells you to do them. So the Veda is pure injunction, or vidhi. Do it. That's what you should do. Now, the later Vedantas will see, disagreed with that, but we'll see that in a minute. And the metaphysics, God can't be proved according to Mimamsa, because there's no God. The Vedas have no beginning and no end. The Vedas are eternal, and they're of non-human authorship. That's a very important aspect of this philosophy. And souls are eternal, but only conscious through action. Souls have no beginning and no end, but only become conscious through embodiment in the world and through action. So the Veda is eternal, is the eternal revelation which was received by the Vedic seers, but has no author. Whereas later traditions thought that God claimed that God was the author of the Vedas. The Mimamsakas rejected that idea, and that the Veda is eternal revelation without beginning, received by these rishis who had the yogic insight, if you like, to receive it. So those are the metaphysical assumptions of the system, and they develop arguments based on those, i.e. that the soul is eternal, there's no God, and that the Veda is eternal and is not of human authorship, and that action, karma, is the most important fact about the universe. Now, coming out of this tradition, you get the Advaita Vedanta that responds to it. And this is arguably the most influential of the Indian philosophical schools, especially Shankara, who is dated traditionally between 788 and 820 CE. And this philosophy maintains that essentially reality is unitary and all differences are real. And the only reality is Brahman, its absolute power. Now, Shankara was a Brahmin born in Kerala. I've been to his birthplace, in fact. It was a small village, really. He probably was born there because there's no political significance to do about the place. It's just a place in Kerala. He traditionally understood as being a Shaiva, although he may have been a Vaishnava, and Paul Hacker argues that he was affiliated to the Vaishnava tradition. And that strikes me as highly likely, because nothing Shaiva really follows from Shankara, even the Dashanamis that were much later anyway. But you do get a very strong Vaishnava tradition following in the Vedanta, the later Vedanta, it's very oriented towards Vaishnavism. So it's highly likely that Shankara was a Vaishnava, and Paul Hacker argues this. And anyway, the story is that he resolved to renounce when he was 7. He found a guru, whose guru was Gaudapada, and he went to Varanasi and thence to the Himalayas, where he wrote his major philosophical work. And Shankara also perhaps spearheaded a Hindu revival against Buddhism and a sort of counter-reformation. And he is credited with founding an order of monks called the Dashanamis, but they are in fact founded several hundred years after Shankara's death. A pedigree was created by them. Now, like the Mimamsa, the main concern of Vedanta was the interpretation of the Vedic scriptures. Now, within these texts, there's a distinction between sections on action and sections on knowledge, karma or jnana. And the Mimamsa says that action is more important and can lead to liberation, although at first they weren't interested in liberation, but in due course they had the idea of liberation comes into it. That action can lead to liberation. And the Vedanta says that only knowledge leads to liberation. There's a big difference between the schools. And there was a school called Beda Beda of Bhaskara, which maintained that both action and liberation lead to liberation. So action and knowledge lead to liberation. But the Mimamsas claim that action is what's important and can lead to liberation, whereas the Vedanta said that only knowledge does, not action. So the Vedas, the Mimamsa, divide into sections on action and sections on knowledge. And the sections on knowledge, they dismissed as being what they call arsapati, merely presumption or merely embellishment, kind of noise, if you like. But what's really important are the sections on action. And one of the Vedanta critiques of Mimamsa was that this is an arbitrary division, that you can't make this division and then claim that one is higher than the other. Or rather, they assumed the distinction, said that actually the knowledge sections are more important than the action, the injunctions to action. So Advaita Vedanta, in contrast, they maintain that liberation is not a thing to be achieved because it's not a future state. Because liberation is present all the time. If liberation is present all the time, it's not something in the future that you can attain. And only knowledge of this can liberate. So no action can lead to this. So if liberation is waking up, as it were, which was maintained by the Vedanta, no action can lead to waking up. So you see a snake in the corner of the room, and you see something, it's a snake, and it actually turns out to be a rope. So it's sudden recognition that the world is Brahman. And that's what's supposed to happen. So no action can lead to that state. It's just waking up. It's the knowledge. What about meditation and contemplation and yogic practice? Shankara classified those as actions. Whereas Mandana Mishra, a later Advaita, the follower of Shankara, says that meditation can, indeed does lead to liberation. But Shankara rejects that view, because for him meditation is an action, and meditation cannot lead to the direct experience, the anubhava, of liberation, because liberation is not caused. How can you cause liberation? If you sit and meditate, you're trying to make liberation happen. You're trying to cause liberation, but liberation is uncaused and you can't make it happen. Knowledge is not... you can't cause liberation to occur. You can just wake up to its truth. This sudden recognition or opening your eyes or shift of perspective. Or you're walking along a beach and you see money and you pick it up and you find it's shells. That sudden recognition. Liberation is like that. If you've done that, you walked along a beach and picked up money thinking it's money, it's shells. No? No.
I picked up the bottle cap and
thought. Suddenly you realise that it's
the bottle cap.
Yeah, that's right. That's that sudden recognition. That Gestalt. Or the two pictures of the vase. You know the picture of the vase? You see it's two faces of a vase. It's that kind of, you can see it as one or the other. So there's not two things, there's only one thing, but you see it in different ways. So likewise, there's only one world, and Brahman is it. And you can either see it in a dualistic sense, through distorted perception, or you can see it in its truth as the absolute reality. And that's liberation. And it's also... liberation. Liberation then is knowing and experiencing the true self, the Atman. And Chakra says it's not like arriving at a place, it's not the result of action, and it's not like dying or losing consciousness, he says. Liberation, what is liberation then? He says liberation is like what happens to the space inside a pot when you smash the pot. So nothing happens, does it, to the space? That's the image that he uses. What happens to the space inside a pot when a pot is broken? Or like what happens to light reflected in a mirror when the mirror is cleaned? So it's like cleaning a mirror. You could argue then that cleaning a mirror is actually action, and that you have to do that to clear the mind, to purify the mind in order to realise liberation. But the logic of his position is that no action can lead to liberation. That it's a recognition, a sudden opening of the eyes to the truth of the world, and that you can't cause liberation to happen. So he accepted that you can have liberation whilst living, Jivan Mukti, and that this is the removal of ignorance, which is to say the eradication of karma. And he, from yoga, you get the classification of karma into different kinds, sanchitta or storehouse karma, which is all the karma you've got from way, way back. It's accumulated over countless lifetimes. There's argamin karma, which is future karma, which will be reaped at a future time. And there's what's called prarabdha, or present karma, and that's what remains. So you eradicate the storehouse and the future karma, but you have to act out your present karma as a pot on a potter's wheel. Once the potter stops turning the wheel, the wheel has its own momentum and just slowly winds to a halt. So once liberated, you live out your life in this body because that's your karma for this body. But once it's finished, there'll be no more birth again. It just kind of winds down. And this Jivan Mukta, one who is liberated in life, who has realised the absolute identity of the world with the absolute, who's realised the identity of the world with the absolute, this Jivan Mukta is non-acting. From an absolute perspective, is non-acting, is incapable of ordinary knowledge, which implies distinctions, and yet from the perspective of relative truth behaves like a renouncer. So you have to introduce the notion of absolute and relative truth here. From an absolute perspective, the Jivan Mukta realizes his true self as a witness consciousness on the world, passive, purely passive witness consciousness, and who is actually incapable of ordinary knowledge because you've realized the identity of the world with the absolute. But from the perspective of relative truth, you behave like a renouncer. And liberation for Shankara only occurs for the renouncer. And he equates liberation with renunciation, in fact. So, very different from the Mimamsakas, and they had great arguments with each other. So, what are the key issues there in some of this kind of material? Before we move on to that, there's another kind of non-dualism. Pratyavijna, which is the Shaiva philosophy, which maintains there's only one reality in the universe, which is consciousness. And so it has superficial a similarity to the Shankara's Advaita, but it criticizes Shankara's Advaita for this notion of passive passivity, that consciousness is not a passive witnessing agent, but is an active dynamic power which is identical with the universe. So you see the universe as pure consciousness. So consciousness is, you project the world out, so there's a projection of consciousness. There's a subject and an object in this system, and that's illusory. This is the objects are a projection of this pure subjectivity, of pure consciousness, whereas in reality, both subjects and objects emanate from this pure consciousness, which is identified with Shiva. And they reject the Advaita view on this because it doesn't have a notion of dynamic consciousness. So the Brahman of a Shankara, an Advaita, is a eunuch, is Kleibya, or a couple of other terms, something like that. Whereas their absolute truth is a dynamic, vibrating energy, vibrating consciousness, identified with light, with which the world is identical. So it's again a shift of perspective, a sudden waking up to the truth of that. But it's a different, very different conceptualization of that absolute. I've been able to go through one of his treatises, where can the mind go that is not Shiva? How can you attain something which you already are? In this kind of language occurs. So key issues then shared by these different schools of philosophy, there's the nature of language, the meaning of scripture, and the relation of the one and the many, and also means of knowledge, and I thought we'd have a look at some of these. So any understanding of Hindu philosophy has to begin with language and communication, which is what the Veda is about. Revelation is communication to the seers, and so to humanity, in the perfected language of Sanskrit. Now language in the Veda inspires and reveals truth, and is the starting point for any theological investigation. So the Vedanta Sutra begins. Now, therefore, the inquiry into the absolute, the Brahma Jignasa, and all the commentators write on that verse. So the and Shankara says, how can that? What does this mean? Inquiry into the absolute. If Jignasa you translate as inquiry, what on earth does that mean? How can there be an inquiry into the absolute? Or knowledge of the absolute, because that implies a dualism, a distinction between self and absolute. So he rejects the very terms on which the possibility of language to begin with to express this relationship between the self and the absolute, because Brahma Jignasa implies distinction between it implies a Tatpurusha compound where this is inquiry or sorry knowledge of the absolute, or inquiry into the absolute, which is the seventh. I can't remember that. Oops. But the problem is, how can there be knowledge of an absolute with which you are identical, that you are? So there's a real problem with language right from the beginning. Now, language or speech, Vaj, pervades the hymns of the Rig Veda, and in the Mandukya Upanishad, the ineffable absolute is linked to the speakable through speech and through the syllable om, aum. So speech is incredibly important, and yet there's also the idea that this absolute with which we're identical is outside of speech, is ineffable. And that language becomes an impediment to its realization. But nevertheless, an early science of language developed in India, which was codified by Panini, and a language theology develops in Bhartra Hari. Oh, I don't want to go into all this, I don't think. no, I'll skip on all of this. So, Let's look at the means of knowledge. Let's go on to the last section, the means of knowledge. Different schools of philosophy, they all share, or they could argue with each other because they share certain terminologies and certain categories. And one of the most important schemes that they share was the pramana system, the system's means of knowledge, the sources of knowledge. And according to Indian philosophy, there are six sources of knowledge. There's perception, pratyaksha, there's inference, i.e. logic, verbal testimony, shabda, which means the Veda, the authority of the Veda, but it also means authoritative testimony by people. So if somebody's, I've never been to Tokyo, but Kyo's been to Tokyo, and he tells me about Tokyo, then I believe him because I accept his authority, although I've never witnessed it myself. So there's that kind of verbal authority. There's comparison, which the absolute liberation is like seeing seeing silver, like seeing coins on the beach, but then recognizing its maker. And there's presumption, which is what the Mimamsa said that the sections on knowledge were. They're just assumptions or presumptions which have no inherent value. And there's non-cognition. So I do not... I see the microphone in front of me, and it's not a monkey. So... The that is there because it's not something else. So it's the difference, I suppose, in a way that it's not. It's language. Language makes sense because it excludes certain other things. The thing is what it is because it excludes something else. So there's non-perception of the monkey on the table because there's a perception of something else. Now, where perception gives us immediate knowledge of the world, inference gives us immediate knowledge. And this was particularly developed in the Nyaya school. For example, we're standing on a hill, and on the opposite hill we see smoke rising. And this is the stock Nyaya example to illustrate the Nyaya syllogism, of which there are five members. So the Pratignya, the hypothesis, the mountain is fire-possessing. There's fire on the mountain. That's the thesis, the proposition. The reason is that the mountain is smoke-possessing. And then you have the examples, as in a kitchen, i.e. you get fire and smoke together in a kitchen, and unlike a lake, where you don't get fire and smoke together. Which actually isn't strictly true. I was thinking you could have you could have a volcano, couldn't you, under the water or something. But, well, that was their practice. I don't know where they're writing this up in Kashmir somewhere. And the application is, what is smoke possessing is fire possessing. And the conclusion is, the mountain is fire possessing. Where there's smoke, there's fire. Now, an application of that structure, here are some Nyaya applications of it. So here's the thesis: sound is non-eternal. This is a critique of the Mimamsa. Mimamsa said that sound was eternal, and the Nyaya rejected that. And the reason is because it has a beginning, because it's grasped by a sense organ, the ear, because it's a product, because it's not experienced prior to its being produced, so you don't hear anything before you hear it, and because we don't experience anything to explain our non-perceiving of sound before it's produced. There's nothing, we don't perceive anything, we don't experience anything which explains our not perceiving the sound before we hear it. So that's an argument against the Mimamsakas, who maintained that sound was eternal. This is Udayana, this is from an 11th century Nyayanika called Udayana. But God's existence is another application. And this is, again, the locus classicus is Udayana's Nyaya Kusumanjali, the offering of the flowers of logic, or something like that. The causal argument: the world is a combination of atoms and eternal infinite substances, which are themselves unconscious. And the world comprises things which are made up of parts, i.e. things are compounds and also unconscious. And every compound is an effect which needs a cause. and this cause must be conscious and intelligent, because it must direct the combinations of atoms. It must be omniscient in order to know what the combinations of these infinite atoms could be. And that cause is God. For example, an axe, which is unconscious, acts only when controlled by a conscious carpenter. So that's a classical causal argument. Another argument: the world has to be created in order that souls can work out their karma, which remains in the souls as an unseen potential form. This potential karma is said to be a force by the Mimamsakas, but such a force is not intelligent and needs conscious direction. The souls themselves do not even know of its presence, so an intelligent agent is needed to guide the process, and this agent is God. You must have an intelligent agent to guide the karmic process. Another argument: the Vedas are true, authoritative revelation. Their author must be God, who alone could know the knowledge which the Vedas impart. I don't think the Mimamsakas thought much of that argument, to be honest. The Vedas tell only the truth. They tell us that God exists, therefore God exists. Well, the Mimamsakas would say, okay, the Vedas tell us the truth, but you have to distinguish between sections, arjapati, and sections on vidhi, between action and sections on speculative sections. And they got out of those kind of those sections about God. Okay, the nature of God. Here's some other arguments. The thesis: God is a substance, dravya. God is a substance. The reason: because he is endowed with a property, namely intelligence and vidhi. Example: as other substances are endowed with properties. But the thesis: God is not like other selves, because he has distinct properties. And because he has distinct properties, other than ordinary souls, God is not just another soul, but is different from other selves. They want to maintain that God is a self, but God is a very special kind of self, because he has distinct properties. These are all very, not circular, but they're arguments within a sort of, within certain presuppositions that could well be rejected by their opponents. Why does God create the universe? So the thesis: God creates the universe, and he does it by reason of his nature, his svabhava, being so as activity. So God cannot help but create the universe, it's his nature to do so. Just as the earth upholds things, because such is its very nature, so God creates the universe, because it's the svabhava, the rupa, the svarupa or svabhava of God to do so. It's part of God's nature. So there's, you've got some examples of arguments from Udayana's text for the existence of God. And it's interesting that Indian thinking came up with causal arguments and argument from design in a way not dissimilar to Western philosophy as well. And indeed, they came up with the syllogism as here. Some have argued that there's influence of Greek thinking on this, but we just don't know. It could have arisen independently within India. So that's a Cook's tour of some Indian philosophy. I'm sorry if you knew all that already, but some of you didn't. Any questions or comments or objections?
Could I just ask something about the word Hetu, which, I mean, would you say it means here cause or? I mean, it's both sometimes, doesn't it?
Reason, really, I would have thought, but yeah, I think there's an ambiguity about the term, really.
I was just thinking in Buddhist logic, it sort of mean root, or, and I just wondered if it had connotation
with
the underlying root.
Right. The basis or something like that. Yeah.
I wondered if it had that application.
Here I think it just means to reason, really. Like the mountain is fire possessing Because it is so possessive.
Right.
Yeah.
So it isn't a cause.
I don't think it's a cause. Yeah. Cause there's no cause
there
relationship.
There
was
relationship between smoke and car. That's the other way around.
No, that's right. It's interesting. Yeah. So that's right. That's important, actually, isn't it? It doesn't mean cause. Yeah. I'd be very interesting to check that out, actually, to look at the uses of the term, see where it means cause and where it doesn't mean cause.
Well, that's what I was wondering. Yeah. It's very specific in Buddhist thought as being
cause.
As I understand it, yes.
Right.
But maybe I've misunderstood. I'll look again.
Right. Yeah. Well, I'm not after look. I mean, yeah. I've always just understood it as reason, really, but cause and reason are very different, aren't they?
Yes.
Yeah. Here it certainly doesn't mean cause,
no.
But it's reason.
But in Bhagavad Gita, I think it's used as cause.
Is it? The Hedgehog is used as cause, is it?
Yeah,
oh,
this is why it's the remembrance.
Right. It actually uses cause, wow.
Hetumadbir.
Right, right. Yeah. So I wonder if this is just a nyaya use of the term. Does anyone know?
I don't know whether in Indian philosophy, other than that, the word hetu is actually used in terms of reason, because cause and effect. It's such a profound relationship.
Yeah.
They forget the concept of reason.
Mm.
And maybe that's why hetu still means cause.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. I suppose in a sense it means cause, in the sense that it's the content of the proposition, but the thesis, the cause of the thesis is the hetu, rather than the actual content of the proposition.
Is there anything in Hindu philosophy the equivalent of the extreme idea of solipsism?
No, I don't think anybody ever took it seriously.
They probably didn't in Western philosophy.
No. I there must be somewhere in the Pali Canon where the Buddha refutes a solipsist. Is there?
I don't know one. That's interesting.
No. I can't think of any examples actually of solipsism in the.
Maybe in the Brahmacharya Sutta or something.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's the sort of thing that one could imagine the Buddha refuting, really. Somebody thinking that. Well, you get very strong idealism, but it's not solipsist. It's always absolute idealism in some sense. Or a weak sense that the world, you can't make any sense of the world independently of consciousness, and there's a strong sense in which the world is actually made of consciousness itself, is identical with it. Well, next week we'll end up with Hinduism and modernity.